From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, we meet a man who's been called a living national treasure, guitarist Doc Watson. Watson's virtuoso guitar playing has earned him 4 Grammy Awards, and his repertoire of Southern Appalachian songs has kept a musical tradition alive. Also today, television writer Sherwood Schwartz tells us how he convinced network executives that a show about a bunch of people marooned on an island could be funny. That show, Gilligan's Island, is still going strong in syndication 25 years later. Singer and guitarist Michael Cooney is back on our weekly performance spot. And Ken Tucker reviews a home video other critics have missed. It's called Basic Plumbing. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Doc Watson is the guitarist usually called the single finest flat picker in the country. The only argument you're likely to get about that is from people who don't want to praise his playing at the expense of praising his singing. It's going on 3 decades that Doc Watson has been one of America's preeminent folk and country performers. He's announced that he plans to retire at the end of March. Through much of his career, Doc Watson performed and toured with his son, guitarist Merle Watson. Merle was tragically killed in a tractor accident a couple of years ago. Before we meet Doc Watson, let's listen to a selection from his latest album, Portrait.
Waked up this morning feeling so blue. I had an awful dream, babe, all about you. And I'm worried now, 'cause I didn't want that dream to come true. That old dream was awful, so awful to me. Dream that I saw you sitting on his knee. And I'm worried now, 'cause that dream has come true, don't you see? There's no use in lying just 'cause you can. Honey, I just saw you with that.
That's I'm Worried Now from Doc Watson's latest album, Portrait. Doc Watson, welcome to Fresh Air. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Pleasure to be here.
I'd like to ask you first, how come you plan on retiring? And are you retiring from music altogether or just from being on the road?
Just from being on the road. I reckon I'll pick a little dab now and then as long as I live. It's been 26 years on the road, or a little better than will be when I retire, and I reckon the stress of the travel is the hard part, and that's why. It's not the music or the love of good audiences that I'm tired of. The road, I don't know, the stress of travel to me is harder than pulling a crosscut saw, and if you never saw a crosscut saw, you don't know what hard work that is.
I've read you say that if you weren't blind, you don't think you would have ever gone on the road, and I wasn't sure how to interpret that.
I wouldn't have, because of exactly what I was talking about. I would rather have a job where I could go home at night. I would have played music, of course. There's no doubt about that, because I think you're born with music or whatever talent that comes out front in your blood, as the old-timers used to say, and you just couldn't help but pick first time a guitar came along. You'd learn it. But it would have been a hobby. I'd like to have been a carpenter or an electrician or something. Kind of work like that, or mechanic, if I could see. I can do rough carpenter work anyway.
But, so you think you would have played, but you wouldn't have toured as much.
Right.
Now, you grew up in North Carolina, where you still live, and I'm just always amazed at the number of families that perform in the South, and I think there were several performers in your family.
Nobody performed professionally but me. My father-in-law, Gaither Carlton, went on the road a trip or two with Merle and I in the early days. And my oldest brother made a couple of trips, Arnold. But they really didn't get into it professionally. And my father-in-law, he hated the road.
Right.
He loved his fiddle. But Lord, he got homesick when he was away from home.
Didn't your father make the first banjo that you played?
Yeah, he did. That was in the summer of 1934. made my first little stringed instrument. I had a harmonica before that. But Dad showed me a few of the old-time Fralin or Clawhammer banjo-style tunes, and one day he brought it to me and put it in my hands and said, "Son, I want you to learn to play this thing real well. Some of these days we'll get you a better one." He said, "Might help you get through the world."
And what was it like for you the first time you got the banjo into your hands? What did you do with it?
I really don't remember. I remember how I felt, but I don't remember hardly what it was like learning the first tunes. It was kind of hard for Dad to show me because I couldn't see his hands, and it was a little tough. But he finally got across to me how to do the licks on the banjo and how to note the thing. And I could figure out where the notes were because it was fretless, and you could slide along with your fingers, and finally you come to the right one, you know, and you found out how to get there without missing them.
So you were really pretty self-taught.
For the most part, yes, I was. The guitar, absolutely, I was self-taught.
How did you get your first guitar?
By pulling the crosscut saw that I mentioned at first. One spring, my dad told my youngest brother and I, "Boys, if you'll cut all those dead chestnut, small dead chestnuts down along the road and around the edge of the field there, you can sell it for pulpwood to the tannery." And we went at it, and we cut a couple of big truckloads. It didn't make us a mint of money, but it made me enough to buy me a good little guitar from, well, I thought it was good at the time, from Sears Roebuck. And my younger brother ordered him a suit of clothes.
Now, considering that your early instruments were homemade banjos and a mail-order guitar, did you ever get really obsessed with the quality of instruments that you were playing? Some musicians just play what they have, and others get really obsessed with having instruments that are just right for them or custom-made for them.
I was fairly contented with what I had. I never had had my hands on a good guitar back in those days and didn't for years. The first good guitar that I got hold of that I would have considered much better than my mail-order box was a Martin guitar that Richard Green used to have a little music store under his, he had a boarding house or an inn there in Boone. And I went in there one day with that little mail-order thing, and he said, "Why don't you let me help you get you a good guitar?" And I said, "Gosh, it costs too much." And he said, "I'll tell you what I can do. I can get you a good Martin D18 that will be a price that you can afford, and I'll take the payments down to $5 a month." And I couldn't beat that. I paid it off quicker than that, but I couldn't beat that with a stick. And at that time, I was playing at the little fruit stand and a little bean market they had in Boone and making me a few shekels on Saturday, having a good time of picking, and I paid for the guitar that summer. He got me that thing at his cost, and it cost $90, and I paid for it. Oh, Lord, I was proud of that guitar. But in all truth, compared to my guitar now, it was like fretting a fence. It was really hard to play.
Well, I guess it's almost good in a way to get used to something like that, because it makes it seem so much easier when you get a good guitar.
Oh, it really does. And when I got into the folk revival in the 60s, I ran into people who could set a guitar action up to where you could play it, and I came on to another Martin along about that time. Played a Gibson at first on the road, borrowed. Then I came into another Martin, and the action was brought down to where you could play it.
My guest is Doc Watson. You know, I'm glad you brought up the folk revival. It was really during the folk revival that you started to become nationally known. I think you'd been playing dances and you know, playing
played
in your
rockabilly music through the 50s and played an electric guitar, Les Paul.
Well, see, this really interests me. You were playing rockabilly and an electric guitar.
Mm-hmm. Rockabilly and old pop standards with an old boy named Jack Williams. Jack had a little group together, and when he heard me pick, he said, "Buddy, I want you to pick with me."
Now, the way I understand it, Ralph Rinsler, who was working at the Smithsonian Institute, came down looking for traditional Southern musicians, came down your way and heard about you.
He was looking for Clarence Ashley and found him, Clarence Tom Ashley. And I had played music with Tom on a few land sales and a few little shows here and there. And Ralph came over, and when he heard me, he persuaded me over my better judgment at the time that I had something to offer in the way of entertainment in the folk revival. So I jumped in there with both hands, I reckon, thinking, well, if I fail at it, it won't mean I didn't try. So I'm here, and Ralph was a member of the Greenbrier Boys at the time.
Now, you had been playing, electric guitar. Did you have to switch over to acoustic in order to make it in the folk revival?
Yeah, switch back to the acoustic. Oh, yeah. Oh, Lord, if you'd have took an electric guitar on the stage on some of those festivals, they would have booed you off the stage if you were supposed to be... used to call me ethnic until they found out I knew a few other tunes but other than the old hand-me-downs, you know, the ballads and the good old tunes that I cut my teeth on. I think I really shocked some people in some of the clubs when I got my foot in the door. Ralph says, now, when you get your foot in the door, you can expand out and play a little of the other music that you've played over the years, but stick strictly to traditional music, the good old ethnic stuff, till you get started. So that's what I did. I kind of deceived people a little, you know.
Well, you must have found it kind of funny, maybe a little bit absurd, that people were so stuck on authenticity, whatever that means.
No, not really. It was surprising, but very pleasantly, because I happen to love old-time music, ballads, the good down-home blues, those kind of things. I happen to love those actually better than any other kind of music. I love the other stuff, a lot of it, very much, and can listen to it contentedly. Even some of the easy listening music I like. But when it come right down to it, I can sit half a day and listen to good folk music. I mean, the real authentic stuff.
Well, I want to play something that was recorded by Ralph Rinsler. Ralph Rinsler recorded it. You were performing.
In my living room. In my living room, yeah.
And this is a recording. It was from the early 1960s. And this is Everyday Dirt. Tell us a little bit about the song before we hear this.
A fellow, David McCarn, was living in a mill town, Gastonia, North Carolina. And he heard about some recording sessions going on down, I think it was Knoxville, Tennessee. And he probably slung his guitar over his back, knowing how those poor old boys fared. He and a fella, Howard, I've forgotten his given name, went over to Knoxville and recorded a bunch of things. And Everyday Dirt was one of the songs that happened in our little record collection when I was a little boy. And those words are just, they're automatic. I didn't even have to think about the lyrics on that. I did have to work at picking it. I learned it off the old 78 record that McCarn recorded.
Okay, so from the early 1960s, this is my guest, Doc Watson.
Now John come home, all in a wonder. He rattled at the door just like thunder. Who is that, Mr. Henley cried? 'Tis my husband you must hire. Then John sat down by the fireside weeping, and up that chimney he got to peeping. There he saw that poor old soul setting up a straddle of the pot rack pole. Then John built on a rousing fire just to suit his own desire. His wife got out with a free good will. Don't do that for the man you'll kill. Then John drenched up and down he fetched him like a coon. When a dog had catched him, he blacked his eyes and then did better. Kicked him out right on his setter. Then his wife, she crawled in under the bed, and he pulled her out by the hair of the head. And when I'm gone, remember then, he kicked her where the chinches had been.
Recorded in the early 1960s, that's my guest, Doug Watson. How did you learn how to pick that way? We found out that you were self-taught, but it seems like it would be really hard to teach yourself an intricate style like
that. Well, by listening to the old records, you could hear after you got... familiarized with the instrument, you could hear what strings they were hitting on and what chord they were playing in just by the sound. After all, music is sound. And I think if anybody learns the guitar properly, they shouldn't, as soon as they can get to where they can, stop looking at the neck and play without doing that, unless it's something really hard that you're getting into. You know, you need to memorize the distances and the jumps on the neck. As I said, music is sound, and I could tell what the guy was doing, the little slide licks on there where he goes down to a certain note and then jumps back up there. All the chords are sound to me. It's like you reading something once I was familiar with the guitar.
Once you put down the electric guitar for the acoustic guitar, how often did you pick up the electric guitar again?
Very seldom. After I got into folk music and into the revival and began to play a little jobs at coffee houses. I don't I seldom, if ever, picked up the electric guitar.
Do you miss it at all?
No, not. I love a good electric guitar. That one wasn't all that good. It was a second, actually. It was a Les Paul Gibson. But it really was a second. The neck on it wasn't all that good. I thought it was a great thing when I first got a hold of it. It had a beautiful sound. But there's some that are so much better now than it was, sound-wise, you know, and as to play, that I picked up a Chet Atkins model electric Gibson the other day, beautiful hollow body. Oh, Lord, now I was interested in that thing.
My guest is Doc Watson, who is one of America's foremost folk and country performers. We're going to talk more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced at WHYY Radio in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Guitarist and singer Doc Watson is my guest. Once you went on the road during the folk revival, now you weren't used to traveling. There must have been a lot you had to learn how to do. Did you have a business manager to help you out with bookings? And
Ralph Rensler did the bookings between he and Manny Greenhill of Folklore Productions. But Ralph traveled a lot with me, and if he didn't, when I went go to New York to work in the city, I came by Trailways bus. Someone would always meet me at the Port Authority and take me over to Ralph's apartment. I worked lots of times. I'd work at Gertie's Folk City a week or 2 weeks at a time, doing either opening act or just playing the job straight there. It was scary. I was as green as a green apple as far as the city. Country boy, you know, really.
Oh, yeah, sure.
As the old-timers used to say, a hayseed for sure. But the scary part finally, and the adventure finally got over with, and that road, it became a job.
Yeah,
music,
I see what
music,
you mean.
A good audience, I love.
You know, I think there's always clubs who, maybe not many, but there's always some clubs willing to take advantage of a performer, and I would guess that someone who was blind was a more likely target if they didn't have people who were watching out for them. Would you ever have any problems with that?
I was glad when my son Merle started on the road with me, because if we went to a place and they didn't treat me too good, Dad, we won't come back here anymore, and that was the end of it. I'd tell Mr. Greenhill, don't book that anymore. That was the end of it. We didn't hit too many places that they weren't really decent to us, but once in a great while there. Of course, I won't call any names because we're on nationwide radio. But we were in a few places where they treated you like pieces of used equipment. And that was the end of playing there. We just didn't do it again. That's the best thing you can do, you know, is not tolerate that. Just move away.
You mentioned your son Merle. Did you teach him how to play guitar?
No. Merle didn't show any interest in the guitar until he was 15. I was on my first concert tour, a little solo concert tour that spring, and about middle ways of it, Ralph called me and said, Doc, I've got some good news. And I said, well, lay it on me. And he said, Merle has started playing the guitar. His mother, Rosalie, started him on the guitar. She taught him his first chords and showed him how to play them and a little bit about timing, and he just took it and went with it. And we met John Hurt for the first time that same summer. We went to the Berkeley Folk Festival, and Merle played backup guitar for me. He'd only been playing about 3 months, and he played backup guitar on the stage. And when we met John Hurt, Merle was enthralled by John's finger style on the guitar, and he took that and added a few little notions of his own, and that's where Merle's finger style came from.
So he never felt that he had to work hard to differentiate his style from your style?
No, Merle, he once in a while he'd ask me for some pointers on a melody to a song or something, but Merle played his very own thing on the guitar. I don't think he even ever asked me how to hold the pick. He probably looked at the way I held it. But I never really sat down and taught him how you get this note or that note. I just played a song and sang it and he jumped in there and learned the lead to it, like Summertime, for instance. I had heard a version of that, and I said, Merle, what do you think about learning this? And I played the thing about halfway through, and he said, gosh, I don't know, it sounds like it'd be hard. And so help me, in 5 minutes, he could play the lead to it. And when we did the recording, I'll say this about it, and then we'll move on. When we did the recording, the producer, Jack Clement, came running through and said, boys, don't touch it. It was the first take. He says, that one's the way it should be. And Merle said, well, it was spontaneous. And he said, Dad, I'll have to go back and memorize what I did. Those things happen in the studio a lot of the time. You know, after you learn a song, you'll hear notes that you just reach for, and they're there. And you play things that you hadn't played before.
Yeah, I've noticed with a lot of musicians that they meet all these people who've memorized their licks, and they have no idea what they played. They were just being spontaneous, and everybody else goes and memorizes it. When your son Merle died, was it hard for you to go back on the road afterwards?
if you'll pardon a little intimacy here, I'll tell you something that happened or I wouldn't have. Between the time he was killed and his funeral, I dreamed I was in a dark desert, and it was so hot you couldn't breathe. And the sand was pulling me down like if you were in quicksand. And that big, strong hand reached back and said, come on, Dad, you can make it. And he brought me, led me out to where it was cool, but there was sunny, but there was a cool breeze. And I waked up and I thought, well, I'll try. And I took up the last job on that particular tour that we'd canceled. And my friend Jack Lawrence had been working some while Merle was off the road with us for quite a while. And Jack stayed on as the other guitarist. And I'm kind of glad I did. If I had stayed off the road a month, I never would have come back. It was so hard, you know. You couldn't know Terry, but it was really hard to go back out there without him.
But I guess that dream kind of gave you permission
I believe it was godsend, I think, mm-hmm, the dream mm-hmm. was.
I want to play a record with you and Merle performing, and this is from an album you recorded together, the Doc Watson, Merle Watson guitar album, and this is Talking to Casey, and Merle Watson is featured on slide guitar. Doc and Merle Watson. Doc Watson is my guest. You know, I've been using the word virtuoso today, and I would guess that one of the problems of being a virtuoso is that people want to hear you play fast all the time, to hear you really, you know, do the most difficult stuff that you can do.
Well, yeah, a lot of people do get into that, but usually, if you have a big audience, you can't really take requests from the when you're on stage, so you just program your set, and you season it with enough of that to keep the people who love the flashy things satisfied and kind of do a sensible set. I don't mind it if people like to hear the flat picking, and it does give you a boost to get a lot of yells and whistles and screams from the audience, you know, but I love the good solid music too. And most of the audience do, really. When it comes right down to it, they like to hear you, the whole scope of the thing. Being accused of being a virtuoso doesn't bother me as bad as people trying to put me on a pedestal, especially when they're my own age.
What do you mean by putting you on a pedestal?
Well, they act like you're a god or something, you know. Lord, I'm just people. Like everybody else, I do play the guitar, but I had to work awful hard at it to learn what I know.
Why is this more difficult for you to cope with if it's someone your own age saying that?
Because they know better. They should know that I'm people. if it's a high school age or a younger boy or a girl that does, I let them get away with it. You know, you let them down easy. You don't agree to it, but you let them down easy. But you think somebody up Doc Watson's age would know that Doc's just a normal human being that likes to pick the guitar. He's not a celebrity. I never have felt like I am, you know. And I don't know how to act like a politician.
You've told us that you plan on retiring. So what are you going to do when you retire?
I'll play on weekends some with a square dance group that I know of around home and pick a little around home. But I think as for the road, once I retire, I think I'll stay out of it. Because if I start dabbling, the first thing I know, I'll be right back out there in the same old drive. And the stress of travel is what I'd like to get away from. To me, it's harder than physical hard work.
Now, what about studio work? Would you ever want to do any of that?
I don't know. I'm going to let that one hang as a question mark. I won't say no or yes.
Can I ask you a question that I hope you don't mind me asking, and if you do, don't answer it. A lot of performers who are blind wear dark glasses when they perform, and that's something you've never done.
I don't know why. I always hated, used to have had a good bit of light perception. Doesn't bother me now because most of it's gone. But the reflection off sunglasses, you know how it'll come in on the sides. I guess they make them now, it won't do it. But boy, they used to try to get me to wear them. I reckon they didn't like the way my eyes looked. A lot of people would say you ought to wear sunglasses. I hated them.
Uh-huh.
I wouldn't do it. And I just never have worn them. I don't know if the blind that wear them, their eyes look really abnormal or what. I don't know. I never did care to wear them, just didn't do it.
Right.
No particular reason except what I told you.
Yeah, well, I could certainly understand that. I mean, I don't understand why they need to be worn by... I guess it's preference, just whether you want to wear them or not.
I suppose, yeah.
One last thing. You know, there's a really nice recording on the album that we heard earlier from the early 60s of you and your wife singing together. Does she still sing? Do you ever sing together?
She doesn't sing anymore or play anymore. The tragedy of losing Merle, Terry, has just about undone her. She does the office work there at home, but she's not Rosalie anymore. Bless her little heart. I don't know, sometimes I just want to cry. And, you know, especially when I'm away from her, I do, when I think about it. I try not to and try to encourage her what I can, but it's been tough on her, and she can't seem to get over the loss. The grief really has her yet.
Yeah, I can understand. Well, you'll be able to spend more time together when you retire. I regret we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for coming, for talking with us about music, and thank you. If you'd like to hear some of Doc Watson's recent music, his latest album, Portrait, is on the Sugar Hill label. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Howard Hessman played the DJ Johnny Fever in the TV series KRP in Cincinnati, and now he stars in Head of the Class as the unconventional teacher Charlie Moore. Howard Hessman will be my guest on our next show.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funding comes from World of Travel Guidebooks, featuring a removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from NPR member stations and from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Sherwood Schwartz has been writing for TV since its inception. He wrote for I Married Joan, The Red Skelton Show, My Favorite Martian. But his crowning achievement came in 1963 when he created Gilligan's Island. Today, millions still watch the show in reruns, and Schwartz has plans to maroon another generation on the island. Coming up, we meet Sherwood Schwartz. Also, singer and guitarist Michael Cooney plays a couple of love songs in our weekly performance spot. And you'd probably never watch a video called Basic Plumbing for entertainment, but our critic Ken Tucker did, and he says it's enthralling. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Lori Waffenschmidt. Republican vice presidential candidate Dan Quayle confronted more questions about his past today. This time the issue was his official biography. Quayle admits his resume is inaccurate in showing that he served 2 years as chief consumer investigator for the Indiana Attorney General. The candidate conceded the error during a flight to Billings, Montana, saying he actually held the post for only a few months. In Geneva, the second day of peace talks between Iran and Iraq saw the two sides avoid direct dialogue with each other and instead communicate through United Nations General Secretary Javier Perez de Cuellar. Iranian officials did announce that any peace settlement in the 8-year war would depend on a 1975 border treaty with Iraq. The BBC's Tim Llewellyn reports that the Iranian demand may be a major hang-up in the talks.
One major problem is that Iraq rejects the 1975 treaty with Iran, which established the common border and is recognized internationally as legally binding, despite the fact that Iraq unilaterally tore it up in 1980. Iraq particularly wants changes in the treaty sections that divide the Shatt al-Arab waterway, Iraq's only outlet to the Gulf. Mr. Veliati, speaking after this morning's separate session, stressed Iran's commitment to the 1975 treaty. Iran will not waver on this and feels it has a solid international case. Iraq feels that the 1975 treaty was imposed by a strong Shah, backed by the Western powers, and is now invalid. Iraq also, apparently, believes that the Secretary General is trying to impose his own peace ideas too fast and too soon.
Tim Llewellyn in Geneva. While the United Nations mediates the peace talks between Iran and Iraq, the UN Security Council today condemned the use of chemical weapons in the Persian Gulf War. By a unanimous vote, the Security Council not only condemned the use of the chemical weapons, but said it would immediately consider appropriate and effective measures if they're used again. The Council did not single out either Iran or Iraq, but UN investigations have repeatedly found evidence that Iraq used mustard gas and possibly nerve gas against Iranian civilians. The Polish government, the Roman Catholic Church, and striking workers today took steps to settle the labor unrest that began in Poland 12 days ago. Solidarity leader Lech Wałęsa says he was approached by government officials about his stance on negotiations. Jane DeBia filed this report from Warsaw.
Wałęsa issued a statement from Gdańsk saying he is ready to start talks anytime, unconditionally, and without thematic restrictions. The Solidarity leader is with more than 1,000 strikers inside the Lenin shipyard. Negotiations are already underway at the port in Szczecin, where dockhands went out last Thursday. A government envoy arrived at the port this afternoon to negotiate the strikers' top priority, legalization of the Solidarity trade union. Workers and management are also discussing demands for higher wages and reinstatement of dockhands who were fired for union activity. Meanwhile, Roman Catholic bishops sharply criticized the government's use of force in breaking strikes among miners and public transportation workers this week. Intimidation and force must be abandoned, the bishops urged, and dialogue must be accepted as the basis for solving all social conflicts. For National Public Radio, I'm Jane Dobia in Warsaw.
Eastern Airlines has been barred from laying off 4,000 unionized workers. The airline has argued the layoffs are part of service reductions needed to stem its large financial losses. Eastern reported a $182 million loss last year. A federal judge today ruled in favor of Eastern's unions, which charged that the cutbacks are really anti-labor tactics. The unions claim Eastern's parent, Texas Air Corporation, has manipulated its financial reports to concentrate losses in its Eastern unit. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained nearly 7 points to close the week at 2017.43. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Michael Cooney joins us again for our weekly performance spot. Michael's best known as a collector of folk songs and ballads, but he also has great affection for pop songs.
Here's a pair of love songs. There are a lot of songs in the world today that purport to be about love, but they seem to be mostly about, oh, baby, 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 set my soul on fire. Oh, baby, 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 you're my heart's desire. Oh, baby, could you hold that mirror just a little higher? Here's a couple of songs from long ago that say it a little more cleverly, I think. Does your mother know you're out, Cecilia? Does she know that I'm about to steal ya? Oh my, when I look in your eyes, something tells me you and I should get together. How's about a little kiss, Cecilia? Just a kiss, you'll never miss, Cecilia. Why do we two keep on wasting time? Oh, Cecilia, come on and say you'll be mine. Does your mother know you're out, Cecilia? Does she know that I'm about to steal ya? Oh my, when I look in your eyes, something tells me you and I should get together. How's about a little kiss, Cecilia? Just a kiss, you'll never miss, Cecilia. Why do we two keep on wasting time? Oh, Cecilia, come on and say you'll be mine. Wasn't that nice? This is nice. I'd like to have a movie set for this. Bring up the movie set. There is no verse to this song, 'cause I don't want to wait a moment too long to say that I'd love to get you on a slow boat to China all to myself alone. Get you and keep you in my arms evermore. Leave all your lovers weeping on a faraway shore, out on the briny with that moon big and shiny, melting your heart of stone. Honey, I'd love to get you on a slow boat to China, all to myself alone. I'd love to get you on a slow boat to China,
all to myself alone. A twist in the rudder and a rip in the sails, drifting and dreaming, throw the compass over the rail. Out on the ocean, far from all the commotion, melting your heart of stone. Honey, I'd love to get you on a slow boat to China, all to myself with nobody else, all to myself alone.
Michael Cooney is based in Maine and plays his music at festivals and clubs across the country. This is Fresh Air.
Hey, Skipper! It's a plane! It's a plane, Skipper! It's a plane!
When it premiered in September of 1963, TV critics hated it, and even the president of CBS was said to be embarrassed by it. But the viewers loved it, and Gilligan's Island was an immediate hit. 25 years later, Gilligan's Island is a cult classic. It's still on TV, in seemingly eternal syndication, and seen by about 2 million viewers every day. Sherwood Schwartz was the man who created Gilligan's Island. He also created The Brady Bunch and wrote for The Joan Davis Show, The Red Skelton Show, My Favorite Martian, and many other TV and radio programs. Sherwood Schwartz has just written a book about his biggest success. It's called Inside Gilligan's Island. Schwartz had a hard time getting this lucrative series on the air. He remembers how he first pitched it to the network executives.
I said that it was about a group of people, very diverse, and in order to establish a diversity of characters, I went not only to characters, but to semi-caricatures. Maybe that's a harsh word, but people who are vivid are obviously more memorable to a viewing audience. So that it wasn't sufficient to make Thurston Howell III very wealthy. I made him a billionaire. And it wasn't sufficient to have a beautiful redhead. I made her a movie star. And it wasn't sufficient to have Gilligan just be a little ignorant. I made him very stupid. And so forth for all the characters. And to take all these people who were so diverse and so separated by their own backgrounds and put them together, there was an immediate clash of all sorts of baggage from previous history of each of the castaways.
I'll tell you what I would have worried about had I been a network executive or had I been you, that it would be impossible to generate enough story ideas for 7 castaways on the same island week after week. Didn't you worry about that?
I didn't worry about that because before I ever went to a network, I felt I had solved that problem.
How?
I got a huge roll of butcher paper, this kind of white paper that they wrap things in. I wrapped it around this whole workroom, this my writing room, and I got a felt tip pen and wrote 31 storylines. If you could do that in a few weeks, circling yourself in a room, certainly with the help of other writers, you could manage to persist for several seasons. And by the way, all 31 were eventually done as half-hour episodes.
Now, the network was concerned that if you didn't explain within the story the premise of Gilligan's Island each week, that the audience would be lost and they wouldn't understand why there were 7 castaways that couldn't get off this island. You suggested that you could take care of that by writing a theme song that would open the show each week that would explain the whole story. That was a very clever idea, I think.
Well, it was a way to do exactly what they feared, which is dead, dull exposition. You could satisfy that particular requirement of why are they there and why they can't get off and so forth with a bouncy theme song.
You suddenly found yourself having to overnight deliver to them a theme song. So before you came up with the song that we actually hear now on Gilligan's Island, you wrote another song, and I was wondering if I could get you to sing the lyrics for the first song that you wrote.
Oh, I don't remember those lyrics. I remember this. It was a Calypso song. Tourists come, tourists go, tourists rocking to and fro. It was like that. It was Harry Belafonte time, certainly not Sherwood Schwartz time.
So instead you ended up with a parody of a sea shanty.
Exactly, exactly.
Just sit right back and you'll hear a tale of a fateful trip that started from this tropic port aboard this tiny ship. The mate was a mighty sailing man, the skipper brave and sure. 5 passengers set sail that day for a 3-hour tour, a 3-hour tour. The weather started getting rough, the tiny ship was tossed. If not for the courage of the fearless crew, the minnow would be lost, the minnow would be lost. The ship's aground on the shore of this uncharted desert isle, with Gilligan, the skipper too, the millionaire and his wife, the movie star, the professor and Mary Ann, here on Gilligan's Island.
Then the episodes even close with a close theme that explains that they're never going to get off this island and you should join us every week to watch their continuing adventures.
You bet, because it's my contention and my belief that a puzzled audience can't laugh and can't be interested. You have to let them know the path you're taking them down. And if you say, these people are locked here, tune in next week and see the new trouble they're in, and you promise them that and you deliver, they will be your friends.
Gilligan's Island was taken off the air pretty suddenly, and I guess you didn't even have time to do a rescue episode. That means you were able to, a few years later, do a special 2-hour rescue episode.
That's exactly.
But in hindsight, would you have preferred doing a half-hour series ending?
The historic point, is that it was better the way it turned out, because when I did the 2-hour show called Rescue from Gilligan's Island, that allowed me, the fact that I didn't do a final episode, allowed me to make a comeback with that show, which led to 2 more 2-hour shows. And I'm currently negotiating for a show called Gilligan's Island, the Second Generation, which is about the sons and daughters of the original castaways.
And how do they end up being castaways themselves? Or are they maybe, am I being presumptuous? Are they not castaways?
No, you're being correct. Thurston Howell IV takes Ginger's daughter and Gilligan's son and the skipper's son, and they all set out to find the island where their parents had spent so many years.
And
they themselves. as you laughed, and rightly so, a storm comes up and they find themselves on this island. But they're rescued by their own parents. It all works out happily.
You also wrote episodes for Ozzie and Harriet. So maybe you can answer the question about Ozzie that everyone in America always wanted to know. What did he do for a living?
He made a lot of money, which is a good thing to do for a living. No, I wrote that show in radio. I didn't write it in television.
Okay. So you're off the hook.
Yes. He didn't have a job in radio either.
And maybe I'm being presumptuous here, but you strike me as someone who grew up in an urban area, Jewish, and here you are creating the prototype for what became the ultimate suburban, goyish sitcom.
So I'm told. Yes, it's you're talking about the white bread Brady Bunch?
Well, that too, yeah. I was even thinking of Ozzie and Harriet and the Brady Bunch.
Look, I have trouble. My rabbi insisted that it would have been a better name, Goldstein's Island. What's wrong with that? Or the Bernstein Bunch, for that matter.
And why didn't you write the Bernstein Bunch?
I deal in a country where there are... I must say, above all, I feel I am commercial in the sense that I like my work to appeal to many people. And that's my satisfaction. So to aim at the biggest, broadest base of audience, you're better off doing the Brady Bunch than the Bernstein Bunch.
Well, let me thank you for talking with us, and I wish you a happy anniversary.
Well, thank you very much.
Sherwood Schwartz's new book is called Inside Gilligan's Island. It's published by Macfarlane.
Very best to make the others comfortable in their tropic island nest.
No phone, no lights,
no motor cars, not a single luxury. Like Robinson Crusoe, it's primitive as can be. So join us here each week, my friends, you're sure to get a smile from seven stranded castaways here on Gilligan's Island.
This is Fresh Air. Let's get a preview of All Things Considered from guest host Daniel Swerdling. Hi, Danny.
Hola, Terry.
What's coming up?
We have an interview with an author of a very disturbing book called Death of a Jewish American Princess. This is about a legal case in Arizona in 1982. A husband murdered his wife. Nobody disputes that. He stabbed her 26 times and was acquitted. Not only was he acquitted, but he inherited what little property she had. And the author of the book, a lawyer, will tell why. We also, on a lighter note, we'll go to a fish market, learn all sorts of things about fish and how to cook them and how Indians try to send fish spirits up to heaven with a woman who's written a wonderful new cookbook called The Great American Seafood Cookbook.
Thanks, Danny. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. One of the most common subgenres of home videos is the self-help tape. Critic and homeowner Ken Tucker just watched Basic Plumbing.
Whether we're talking about losing weight, learning how to play the harmonica, or making repairs on your home, there's a tedious, cheaply filmed video cassette for your area of interest. I wonder if there are also people like me, people who may not actually want to attempt whatever skill the self-help video is promoting, but who like to see how they might do it if they had the ambition or the energy. That's the most charitable reason I can think of, at any rate, for why I sat enthralled in front of Basic Plumbing, part of the Ortho video series. Basic Plumbing is an hour's worth of high drama, clogged drains, leaking faucets, backed up toilets. I don't know about you, but that sort of stuff scares me a lot more than a nightmare on Elm Street. When I see water leaking or not draining anywhere, my first thought is to run screaming from the room. Basic Plumbing, however, is the pure voice of reason.
With a little know-how, we can perform almost all routine plumbing tasks ourselves. We can make emergency repairs like fixing the toilet that overflows on Sunday mornings or the sink that clogs just before guests arrive. Soon, projects that we thought were hard will look much easier.
Like most self-help videos, Basic Plumbing features wooden actors reacting slowly and dully to situations that would reduce most of us to expletive-filled ranting. But the instructions given here are very clear, and when combined by the zombie-like quality of the performers, the video radiates an unearthly calm while filling your head with information. Here, for example, are a couple of regular guys going through the basement of their weekend home, checking for nasty leaks.
Too bad the pipes froze and caused this. I thought we had rubber pads and clamps for jobs like that.
We used them last year, but, you know, any piece of rubber will do.
Kitchen glove.
Sure. Great. Put the rubber around the pipe, then attach the hose clamp and tighten. There, you got it. That'll hold it.
As in any good video of this kind, everything is made to look easy. The most average homeowner has just the right set of pliers, everyone seems to know what a valve seat wrench is, and all these folks have something called a closet auger in the house. It's kept in the closet until the bathtub overflows, I guess. I still don't think I'm going to go out and buy one of those long pieces of wire, a snake we call it in the trade, or restrain myself from calling a plumber the moment the shower gets stopped up. Still, if I was the slightest bit adventurous or handy, Basic Plumbing would be my video Bible. New video cassette releases include Cry Freedom, Richard Attenborough's overblown epic biography of South African activist Stephen Biko. The movie features a terrific performance by Denzel Washington as Biko, but most of the movie focuses on the soulful eyes of Kevin Kline as a noble journalist. There's also Tampopo, a widely praised 1987 comedy by the Japanese director Huzo Itami. But Tampopo soon becomes the cinematic equivalent to an M.F.K. Fisher essay, a piece of art that exists to communicate the joys of eating.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Here's a look at the next fresh air. Next time, we meet the man Esquire magazine called the godfather of neoliberalism, Charles Peters. Peters is the founder of the Washington Monthly magazine, which is dedicated to uncovering that which bureaucracy has tried to hide. He's written an autobiography titled Tilting at Windmills. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the Benny Goodman Archives, Volume 1. It's the first release of the vintage recordings the late bandleader bequeathed to Yale University. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews Frederick Wiseman's latest documentary. It's called Missile. It's about the training of the launch crews that man U.S. missile silos. I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from NPR member stations and from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Ed Doherty. Production assistance from Lisa Bruton and Deborah Beagle. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.